This podcast is a part of Straight Up Strange Productions. Discover more shows like this one at straightupstrange.com.
You are listening to the Oddball Aussie Podcast with me, your host, Oz Oddball. During this episode, you may hear things that challenge your own beliefs, but please have an open mind and enjoy. You can follow me on Twitter and Instagram at Aussie Oddball, and if you have any stories you want to share, send them to theoddballaussie@hotmail.com. Sit back, relax, and enjoy. Welcome back to the Oddball Aussie Podcast. Yes, it has been a long time since I did my last show. So we had a bit of a break. I just needed to get a lot of things sorted. I wanted to start researching some new and different things. And quite frankly, also, the show nearly came to an end. I did consider maybe pulling the plug and finishing up, but it didn't feel right. I knew I was going to miss it too much, and it's become a big part of my life. This is nearly 3 years we've been going for, and this has probably been the quieter year I've had. And that's just been just because of trying to balance it. But I found a pretty good balance now. I'm pretty sure we're ready to get back into things. So we're kicking off with a very big episode tonight. This is an interview with Mick West, and we did this interview a couple of months ago. So I apologize, Mick, if you're listening, for how long this took to get out there. And it was a great interview. As for the show, what's coming next? Well, the Oddball Files are still going to be out there. We're still going to do the wacky, weird stuff, the unknown, the mysteries. We're still going to do those short episodes. I want to stick with them. We can all keep the collage of information and all that, and good for new investigators and good for people who just want to, you know, maybe come back into it. But I also want to start going into some darker stuff, some deeper stuff. Things like cults, secret societies, rituals and ritualistic behavior. Why humans do what they do. Why we form these groups and why we follow leaders that maybe shouldn't be leaders. I also want to dive into things like missing persons reports that have never been solved. I want to, not so much murders and things like that, I'm not really interested in that, but more the mysteries. I really want to start diving into some of that darker content. So that might not be for everyone. It's something new I need to do to go to that next level with the podcast. And to keep myself entertained as well, because as much as I want to entertain all of you, I need to enjoy what I'm putting out there as well. So I want to sort of get into that darker stuff. As I said, the lighter stuff in the form of the Oddball Files will still be there for everyone to enjoy. We'll still be pumping those out. And the bigger episodes may not be as frequent. We may do at least one a month, but they're going to be a bigger subject. I think it's going to be something that's going to be really, really interesting, and I hope you will join me on that and keep on listening. So that explains where I've been. Now let's get into the interview tonight. It's a big one. Can be seen as very controversial. So here we go. This interview is with Mick West. Now, for those of you who don't know who Mick is, I strongly urge you to go and have a look. Start with his Twitter page. That's where I started. And from there, you'll find a lot of links. There'll be links in the description as well below. Now, he can be seen as a bit of a controversial character in the ufology circles because amongst ufology, he has debunked quite a few things. And he also talks a lot about finding the reason why something is the way it is in a picture, for example. He doesn't just go straight to, yes, it must be aliens. So, as I said, very interesting person. I respect him quite a bit. Some of you may not. Some of you who listen may not like him at all. But I still urge you to please listen. We do need to listen to both sides of the field. We can't always just be caught in our own little bubble. So this is where we're going to dive into some skeptical talk, and we're going to discuss some of the traps that people get caught in when it comes to finding something they believe is a unknown or strange encounter, especially around ufology. And so Mick did a really good video on debunking the Tic Tac video, and I'll have that link below as well. I urge you to go and watch that because it did change my mind about a lot of things. It made me think of it in a much more technical means, so more like a more from the engineering point of view of how the camera is actually designed that's on that aircraft. I think that that made it quite different for me. So definitely have a look at it. But without further ado, here's Mick West and my interview. And I hope you enjoy. If you don't enjoy, then that's fine. But please keep an open mind. All right. Talk to you all later. Mick West. So everyone listening, this is our first interview of 2022. Haven't done an interview since last year, so it's great to have Mick West on. And yeah, we're going to talk about some things that are a little bit different today. A lot of time the guests I've had on previously are very much true believers and are very much into a lot of stranger theories. Whereas Mick is, we're going to talk about more of the skeptical side today. So hopefully a lot of my true believer listeners aren't going to have your buttons pushed too much, but this is my skeptical side coming out as well. I sit very much on the fence a lot of times with things, but more recently I've been getting pushed to more skeptical opinions about things. So welcome, Mick.
Well, glad to be here.
Thank you again for doing the interview. I really appreciate it. Trying to get a lot more different opinions and personal beliefs on the show, so we're not all stacked on the side of true believers, because I think it is healthy to have a skeptical opinion about things as well.
Yeah, I agree, and I think it's great to have some kind of just basically so we know what everybody is talking about. I think too often people they just kind of stay in their lane and they don't engage what they view as being like the other side or the opposition, you know, in some ways.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't really see myself as the opposition. Like with the stuff I talk about, a lot of the times I get on fairly well with a lot of the people in the various communities that I talk about, you know, specifically the UFO one more recently. But even, you know, even say stuff like 9/11 debunking, you get to know people and you get to have some kind of mutual respect, which is really helpful.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's there's so much division in everything nowadays, isn't there? Everything needs to be, you're either on one side or the other. You can't, I remember growing up and my parents could pick and choose. They weren't, you know, aligned to one political party. They could say, well, I like this about this person, I like that about that person. But nowadays hopefully we're coming out of it soon, I think, but currently we're in a position where it is very polarizing. It's pick one side or pick the other. You're either a true believer or a complete skeptical.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I've constantly had to try to fight against, and not fight in a kind of aggressive way, but just it's an issue because people come into a conversation kind of almost being angry with you from the start. If they see you that you have like what they view as, you know, an opposing view to their worldview, no matter what it is, really, they get very, very angry. And they assume that you are taking this kind of adversarial point of view, that you are, you know, you're setting up to either gaslight them or to try to trick them in some way. And so they're very, very wary and they're very, very reluctant to kind of engage with the things you're saying because they feel like you're trying to trick them. So it's a big challenge to get past that. And, you know, kind of developed a variety of techniques over the years, but basically it just boils down to just being honest and friendly and open and very clear in what you're doing and not putting the other guy down.
Yeah.
That's a huge thing. If you're respectful, it works really well.
And I think, my opinion on that is a lot of people have been burned by standard media. You watch the morning programs where they bring on someone who says they've been abducted by aliens. And whether or not the person has, whether it's a psychological issue or not,
they always started with the UFO, with the ET music playing in the background, or the X-Files music,
yeah.
and then
yeah.
and then they'll have like a little cartoon of a cow being beamed up, and then the person doesn't realize it's happening in the background until after the fact, and everyone else who may have this sort of situation will never talk about it to other people, or as you said, they'll go in with that defensive mode already up. They already think they're going to be attacked. And I've had that with a few of the people I've had on who truly believe they've had interactions with extraterrestrials. And as soon as you sort of, the start of the interview, they will be very defensive. And so we've sort of just started straight into this. But for a lot of them, I'll have a half an hour conversation with them first. Because to let them know that I'm not going to be in the background here playing weird sounds over top of them, and you know, it's, and I think a lot of media and a lot of podcasters are probably to blame for a bit of that mistrust with people.
Yeah, it's definitely an issue. I try to be straightforward with people. You know, when someone comes to me and they tell me an extraordinary story, I usually tell them that I believe them, in the sense that I don't think that they are lying. Because most people who tell you these stories, they're not liars. You know, there's this false dichotomy that we get a lot, where people say if someone's either telling the truth or they're telling lies, and that's just you know, it's a ridiculous way of looking at things. You know, people can tell the truth, or they can tell something that is wrong, but they think they're telling the truth. They've just made a mistake, or they've had some kind of, you know, like a false memory or an illusion or something like that. I want to get away from the idea that I'm accusing people of lying. Very few people. You know, we know that there's some channels that just put stuff out there on YouTube, and it's just basically clickbait, and they're making stuff up, and they're fake videos and things like that. So we know that there's some people do that, but most of the individual experiencers genuinely think that they had this experience, and for all I know, perhaps they did. So from my perspective, it sounds like something that's very unlikely to be true, but I don't think they're lying, and I'd leave open the possibility that it is true, and then we start from there.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. And I always say at the end of my interviews with people who have had encounters, to my audience who are listening, because I have a very good balance, mixture of skeptics and believers, and people who just love listening to some of the folklore that I talk about. And I always say at the end, regardless of your thoughts on this, the person who I'm interviewing truly believes they had that experience. And that's not for me to say they didn't. As you said, there could be a lot of reasons why it's not real, but to them it's true. So they believe it happened. So you've sort of got to let them come to terms with whatever they're dealing with, whether it's a psychological problem, maybe they had issues with their home life or anything like that, or they said maybe it really did happen, and we're sort of just shutting our brain down to that.
Yeah, and you got to be careful though. You don't even want to like leap in with like maybe it's psychological problems, or maybe maybe it was this, because you know, if you start talking to people about, oh, I think perhaps, you know, your explanation is that you have psychological problems, that's going to shut them down as well. You know, obviously, like, some people do have psychological problems, and perhaps some people have had some kind of hallucination or something, or some kind of delusional memory or something like that. But you know, a lot of people, like, it happened perhaps in a non-psychological way, just simply they had a dream, or they saw something that from a certain perspective they thought was something. So I think you really got to be wary about this, you know, saying that, you know, someone might have psychological problems.
Certainly.
No. Assume that, start from the possibility that you're talking to a person who is just a perfectly reasonable, sane person who thinks they had an experience, and then you try to figure out what actually happened. And there's a few possibilities. Yeah, maybe you'd include, you know, there are a crazy person on that list somewhere, but probably you don't want to start there.
Yeah, of course. And I think a lot of people as well, what I've watched from more the negative side of skepticism is people try to bring alcohol and drugs into it. And they'll say, well, this person was obviously on hallucinogens. If you look back through the history, they did a podcast 3 years ago where they talked about hallucinogenics. And it's like, well, that doesn't mean necessarily that they were on those hallucinogenics at the time.
Yeah.
It just means they've tried them.
Yeah. And probably if you did some kind of correlation analysis with were people drinking or, you know, on drugs at the time of their sighting, you would probably see a bit higher, you know, correlation there than other things.
Certainly.
Because it's going to have an effect on your perceptions. But yep. It's a big mistake to try to say, like, you know, that everything is just people who are, like, you know, on drugs or they're crazy or they're, you know, they were drunk at the time. Because you don't know that.
And to start a lot of with people, that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And the people you're talking to, they think they know what their state of mind was at the time. And often they will describe seeing something with incredible clarity and the memory is very, very clear. You know, memory doesn't work quite as well as you think it does, but in their mind, the memory is very clear. And, you know, they probably say they weren't taking any drugs, or if they were, it wasn't actually an issue. You know, you could be smoking a joint or something. It doesn't mean you're going to start seeing flying saucers coming out of the sky. It just makes you a bit more relaxed. You know,
it's exactly right.
Necessarily, you know, one thing or another. But, you know, a lot of people who have these experiences, they're not necessarily actually even going to be talking to you about them. A lot of people who are believers in UFOs, like the true believers, they kind of base their belief on something that actually happened to them that they've never actually talked about.
Yep.
Because they don't want to get this scrutiny and this ridicule that comes along with that. So you get people who are simply come across initially just as believers, and you don't know why they're believers, but it turns out they've had like some kind of deep experience, like Gary Nolan, the professor at Stanford. He had some kind of experience, and I think he was talking with Kurt on Theory of Everything, and they were both sharing stories that they'd not talked about before, where they've had some kind of experience of a voice speaking to them in their head, which is a relatively common thing that happens with people. You know, at some point in their lives, you hear a voice, you know, talking to you, and it's just probably something to do with the way the brain works. But from their perspective, it felt like this kind of perhaps a view into another consciousness. And for them, it seems very significant.
That's really, really interesting. I've talked to a lot of people who do a lot of hiking. I've done quite a bit of hiking myself in the past, and they'll talk about occasions where they'll just be in the forest and they'll hear what sounds like a just a loud crack but they say it's not external, it's internal. Or they'll hear a voice or something just when they're by themselves.
Yeah.
And they know it's not them. They know it's not them. They know it's not some external factor. They just think it's probably maybe the mind's wandering, almost like a subconscious thing that's happening as they're going on their hike.
Yeah, it happens. Mind works there's
interesting ways.
It does. There's like a thing called exploding head syndrome.
Yes,
which is a real thing, where people they essentially hear explosions in their head as if their head is exploding, and it feels like a real thing to them.
Yeah, I think I've had that. It was like 3 o'clock in the morning. I was doing some editing and I was getting some stuff finished for the podcast and some stuff for my normal work. And I remember just my head dozing off and then a loud crack sound. And I woke up straight away. And 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm in a very, very quiet neighborhood, mostly of elderly people in my street. And I can't think of anything it would have been. I went out back. I couldn't find anything. And I found out about that a few months after. And I was like, oh, I wonder if that's what that was.
It could be. It could be. And there's a theory that the human mind kind of evolved in a way where consciousness was originally what they call a bicameral, meaning like there's actually two chambers in your mind. Two parts of the mind, and essentially consciousness kind of evolved from your subconscious talking to you. So people would actually experience auditory hallucinations of their own subconsciousness telling them to do things.
And that's
kind of like a theory of the evolution of consciousness. It's called the origin of consciousness in the breakdown of the bicameral mind. So they think that not that long ago, and recently enough, so it's reflected in recent literature, like you say in the Odyssey, the Homer's The Odyssey, and the Iliad, you know, these ancient epics. You have the heroes talking to gods.
Yeah.
And the theory is that that's actually them talking to their inner voices, which get perceived as gods. And they didn't really have this kind of self-awareness back then. If you read these old texts, the idea is that the people weren't, you know, self-aware in the idea that they had consciousness, but they were very aware of these voices constantly talking to them and telling them to do things, like their gut telling them to do something, their heart telling them to do something, their head telling them, and then the gods telling them to do things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, the idea is that this is a natural part of human evolution, but it's something that's kind of got lost as we became more conscious and we just have our own, you know, in a dialogue which we recognize as ourselves. But sometimes that can break down. And the old way of doing things, the more primitive mind, can kind of break through and you start hearing voices because of this weird way consciousness evolved.
I can imagine that too with the idea of gods and things around the world is when you've got that inner monologue if during evolution when they said they didn't understand what that was. Nowadays, when I'm going through my shopping list, I can speak in my own head and go through my shopping list, and I know that that's me. I know that's not some external voice telling me that I need to buy eggs. But back then, if they weren't completely conscious of what that was, that's a really interesting theory.
Yeah, and from that, there's another interesting thing that comes along, which is that people's inner dialogues are different. Some people say that they don't have an inner dialogue. And then some people will describe an inner dialogue, which to me sounds ridiculously overcomplicated. Like when I'm thinking about something, I don't talk it through in my head exactly, but I can kind of think, you know, I'm thinking about this, but sometimes I say things out loud because it's easier.
Yep.
But then some people say that whenever they're thinking about things, they always think through it in their head, and they have kind of an inner dialogue of almost with themselves. You know, what should I say next? I'm going to say this, and then they say it. And other people say there's nothing at all like that. They just say things. And then there's things like aphantasia, where people have an inability to form a mental picture. Like if you close your eyes and picture an apple, you can kind of imagine what an apple looks like, and you can kind of think of that as you conjuring up an image of an apple. Some people say that they can't do that.
I didn't know that one.
Then you apply that type of complication to UFOs.
Yep.
Say someone saw a UFO, their recollection and their description and their mental image of it is going to be very different depending on whether they have, what degree of aphantasia they have, what degree of mental visual dialogues they have, and what kind of actual inner discussions do they have. Perhaps they formulate memories by talking about it in their own head. Whereas other people just are more image based. So, I think there's an issue with just trying to imagine everybody's brains work the same way, when everybody's brains work very differently. And there's people on the autism spectrum who are in many ways very high functioning people, but they think about things in a very different way to people who are not on the autism spectrum or in a different position on the autism spectrum. So you can't just say, oh, well, this type of thing is responsible for sightings, or this is, people remember things because of this. There's all these different things, and you gotta really consider that everybody's a very individual mind.
Yeah, that's interesting, because for my normal career, I'm a learning facilitator, and I'll have 30 to 40 people in a class. And it's interesting when you say that, because you'll have so many different people who, these people over here, they will be analytical. These people over here, they will love it when I tell real life stories about certain things and relate it to that. Others find the real life stories, they can't relate to it at all. And what they need is imagery. They need videos or visual stimuli. It is really interesting how everyone's minds work.
And that works both for... both for like just talking to people about their experiences, but also like trying to explain things to people. You can't just do one explanation and expect it to work for everybody. You've probably seen like there's some video. Well, there's a Reddit group explaining it to me like I'm five, which is kind of a good way of doing things. But then there's also a YouTube series where they take the same thing, like gravity, say, and then they explain it to a five-year-old, and then they explain it to like a teenager, and then they explain it to someone at college, and then they explain it to someone with a PhD. And you're explaining the same thing to people with very different ways of thinking about the world. And so it comes out very differently, but you kind of have to do that if you're going to reach everyone.
My, it's funny. My son came up to me one day. He was only five at the time, and he picked up one of my pens on my desk and dropped it and said, "Dad, that's gravity." I was like, "Well, you're not wrong." Like, I was like, 5 year old thinking like that. That was really interesting. And
that's great.
And he didn't need to know the mathematics of it. He didn't need to know who came up with it. Yeah. He had just heard of this idea that gravity brings things down to earth. And pen dropping on the ground, that was gravity. I was like, okay, yep. I see what you're saying.
Well, I actually have a memory, which I could be just reinventing in my own memory, of discovering gravity myself. And I felt like before I discovered gravity, I had the idea that whenever you dropped something, you let go of it and then it was on the ground. I thought, at the time there was no kind of, there's nothing in between these. And I never noticed the fact that when you drop something, it actually travels through the air to get to the ground. I had this very simplistic idea in my head. I must have been like three or something, or probably younger than that, one and a half or two or something like that. And I remember, I think it's probably like when you transition from being like a toddler to, from crawling around to actually standing up, you get a little higher. As a baby, everything's close to the ground. So there's no real dropping things as a baby. You let go of something, it's on the ground. Then you get to be a bit taller. You notice, oh, we actually traveled through the ground, through the air. That's interesting.
Yeah.
So it's fascinating how you could just simply not think about something like gravity.
Yeah. Yeah. And we see that with people, elderly people, when they're going through things like dementia, because that's mostly what I teach is aged care studies. And we'll see that with people with dementia will start to shuffle. The idea of gravity with their feet. The idea of connection to the ground with their feet is such a terrifying thing to lift their foot off the ground. Right. Because if I lift my foot off the ground, will I touch ground again? Is there anything underneath me? They separate from the earth. It is really interesting. You'll see them, they'll have to grab onto guide rails and they'll hold them with both hands, or you'll see people start to get very tactile about things. They'll rub their hands together quite a bit, or they'll start having to, you see a lot of them with the little babies that they give them, the toy babies, and they nurse them, they look after them. And it's all part of the mind disassociating with who they really are, and almost a regression. So it's really interesting how the mind goes up, and then obviously it doesn't happen to everyone, but
fingers crossed. But
fingers crossed. Yeah, and certainly I get irritated with people who say if my dad had just kept on doing his crossword puzzles, he wouldn't have dementia. And I say to them, well, if crossword puzzles were the cue word to dementia, doctors would be prescribing them books every week. But we don't have that. Yeah. If we can train our brains, of course, we can strengthen our minds. But there's just certain things in our genetic, in our DNA that just sometimes go off like little explosions in the mind. So just getting to, where can my listeners find you in other places? So I know you've written a book.
I have written a book. It is right there. Escaping the Rabbit Hole.
Yep.
How to Debunk Conspiracy Theories Using Facts, Logic, and Respect. Keyword being respect, and not so much about the debunking, which I think turns people off. It's really about how to talk to people who are kind of stuck in conspiracy theories, and specifically friends and relatives. Yep. So it addresses a number of conspiracy theories like chemtrails and 9/11 and flat earth and false flag shootings like Sandy Hook, which in some ways they're a little bit outdated now because everyone's more into QAnon and vaccines and things like that. But the basic techniques are still valid. And then I spend a lot of time on Twitter. So if someone wants to see what I'm up to, they can just follow me on Twitter at Mick West.
Excellent, excellent. And where can people purchase that book from? Amazon or?
Yeah, it's available online, and pretty much anywhere books are sold. In the virtual world now. It used to be in bookstores, but
excellent. I'll be buying a copy because every time I have someone on, generally they've written a book or they've created something, so I always add their book to my library. So I've got a very diverse library going at the moment. No, that's excellent. So when we discuss, when we're thinking about conspiracy theories and stuff like that, this day and age right now, it feels like everything is a conspiracy theory. It feels like, you know, milk is a conspiracy theory. There's something in your milk. There's something in your bread. Yeah. Why do you think we are going that way?
Well, I think it's to do with the internet. Yeah. It's not really that the internet is making people into conspiracy theorists. It's that it's kind of enabling natural tendencies that people have. You know, people have always been very suspicious. People have followed crazy conspiracy theories since a very long time ago. You know, if you look back to like when major events happen, people look for someone to blame. Look back to the Black Death in the 1300s. The people were looking for someone to blame. They didn't know that it was just, you know, rats and fleas. And so they picked the Jews. Yeah. And they said, well, you know, obviously the Jews have affronted God, so we're going to deal with this issue, and we think that the Jews have been poisoning the water, so we're going to round up all the Jews and stick them in a house and burn them. And this happened through a lot of cities and towns in Europe during that time. They actually the Pope tried to step in to end it because he knew that the Jews weren't responsible for any of this. But you know, people just have this natural desire to blame people for things.
It's easier to personify something, isn't it? It's easier to put a person behind it than some creature or something like that. If I can have an enemy, then I can. If I can create an enemy, I can defeat an enemy. It's quite an archaic thing of.
Yeah, it does two things really. Like naming your enemy, it puts a face on it and it gives it an easy to understand explanation. You can just say, oh, this is because of, you know, these people, say the government. You know, people distrust the government is the big thing right now. And always has been. You know, people distrust the government, especially if it's the governments who are opposing political party to the one you believe in. Yep. But if you say, you know, that is why this thing happened, it makes the world seem simpler. You know, if you don't have that person to blame, you get this big cognitive dissonance because you don't know why something happened. You know, you look at something like 9/11, and you see these extraordinary things happen, like planes fly into buildings, and the buildings collapse in this like very dramatic manner, and you can't wrap your head around it. But if you simply say, oh, it was just a big plot by the government, and here's some architects and engineers who have an explanation of, you know, how the government did it. And so that makes perfect sense. It's a lot easier than having the idea that, you know, a plane crashes into a building and then it collapses in this bizarre manner, which is very difficult to understand. So people just gravitate towards this thing, and especially if it fits their worldview. If you already believe that the government is evil and can do these things, then it makes it very easy to believe something else. So if you're believing something like, you know, the 9/11 conspiracy theory, super easy to jump from that to believing that they invented COVID or that they are using 5G to control your mind or something like that.
Exactly.
Because if they can do one extraordinary thing, there's nothing to stop them doing another one.
And I don't think governments help themselves very, very well with things they have done in the past, things they have covered up and they have come out with. People use that as a stepping stone. Yeah. So things like Havana Syndrome, things like Bay of Pigs, Gulf of Tonkin, things that have got a baseline of truth to them,
Well, yes.
Extrapolate from that, you know, and
yeah. Yeah, but often a guard path. Often incompletely. I think people then take things like Bay of Tonkin and there was a set of proposals, Operation Northwood.
There's a set
of proposals that were basically pretexts to invade Cuba. That the Joint Chiefs of Staff requested that people come up with some pretext that they could fake false flags, essentially, so that they could invade Cuba. And they suggested a number of things, like one of which was like pretending to have a plane be shot down, and other things were like stirring up trouble in the Cuban community and like having some bombs planted in various places. None of that was done.
No.
It was just like a bunch of talking points, like ideas. But people then take that as if it was this well-formed plan that the government had to do all these things, these false flag things.
Yep.
And they kind of ignore the fact that none of it actually happened. And then they say, of course, if they're not going to tell you if it happened. But, we've got no evidence that it happened. We know that the Joint Chiefs of Staff requested some ideas for pretexts to invade Cuba. So somebody went away and they sat down and what can we do? Well, let's see. We could pretend to blow up a plane. Yeah, let's write that down. And then they come up with a bunch of other ideas, and they maybe refine them a little bit so they don't sound entirely stupid. And then they basically send them back to the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and then it got nixed. It was like, this is kind of silly, really. Let's not do it. We don't know what happened then.
Could have been that one guy in the corner of the room saying whatever came to his head first. And
it could be. And it's like a brainstorming session.
Yeah,
and that's exactly what it reads like. These are provisional ideas. It's not like we are going to do all of these 12 different things. It's here's 12 different things. Maybe we can do one of them, and they didn't do any of them.
Yeah.
And then people say it didn't happen because JFK stepped in and canceled it, and that's why he was assassinated.
Yeah.
So you can kind of tie everything together. But what really happened was it was actually kind of between the Bay of Pigs and the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Yeah.
So it was maybe 6 months, I think, before the Cuban Missile Crisis, 1962, I think. And once you had the Cuban Missile Crisis, you had nuclear missiles in Cuba. You didn't need any stupid pretext.
No.
We were on the brink of nuclear war back then, so it just all became completely irrelevant and never went anywhere.
And I think you point out something really good there: timelines. People don't form timelines; they just take little bits of data and they'll pin it to the wall. Well, not even pin it to the wall. They'll throw it at the wall and hope it sticks. And then they'll just tie it together. And really what people need to do is start with the baseline. Where did it begin? And that would have been well and truly years before Kennedy was even in power. So you start there and then you work your way through. And then you can find where the differences are. And it pretty much explains itself. It is fairly transparent.
Yeah.
But
you've already got to look at context. Sometimes. You got to look at context, and there's another famous JFK conspiracy thing where it's a speech he gave where he says, we are as a nation opposed to secret societies.
Yep.
And then he talks about, I can't remember the exact words, but there's a great conspiracy around the world whose meetings are secret and its actions are hidden, and it's intending to destroy the world or the United States. Yeah. And so people take this as JFK warning people about the deep state, like some kind of like secret society discovered. Like in the Masons, and he's telling people, there's this secret society. But it's not. If you look at the context of that speech, it's a speech he gave just after the Bay of Pigs, same kind of timeline issues here. And he gave it to the Association of Newspaper Editors in the United States. And the issue that he was talking about was fairly specific. It was the need for newspapers to be self-regulating in not giving out government secrets about things like the Bay of Pigs.
Yep.
Because there were some thoughts that the Bay of Pigs, which was this invasion of Cuba by former Cuban nationals that went terribly wrong, helped by the CIA, that might have partly failed because people were talking about things in newspapers.
Yep.
And so he's saying that, you know, newspapers, like, we are opposed to a secret society. We are opposed to regulations that censorship. But if you keep doing this type of thing, then we might be forced to impose some regulations.
Yep.
And that's all he was talking about. The great conspiracy he's talking about was communism. He says, yes, specifically in there, it says it conducts the Cold War with ruthless efficiency. He's obviously talking about communism. He's not talking about some secret society within the United States. But, you know, people just, you get these little memes with a picture of JFK on one side and then, you know, big conspiracy on the other side. And you miss this huge wall of context, which is necessary to understand.
It drives me insane. The things on Facebook that people just throw together. Mm-hmm. And I have friends of mine, I have family who will retweet these things, reshare these things, and then I'll be sitting at a barbecue with them or having drinks with them on Friday night, and they'll say, Steve, yeah, have you seen this? have you looked at this? And I'll say, yeah, no, that's wrong because of this, this, and this. Oh, no, that's what they want you to think. And I always ask them, who's they? Yeah. Who is the they? Oh, well, you know, it's always big someone, big pharma, big government, big, you know, 4G. Whatever. Yeah. There's always a boogeyman in the corner. I wonder if that's something that we've sort of we've grown accustomed to there always being a big bad guy. You consider the hero story, you consider you know, movies, TV shows, mm-hmm. And even in society. I mean, you go back to World War I, World War II, there was always a big leader we were taking on. So World War II, obviously Hitler, we were taking on this this big bad guy. And it seems that humans always want this one adversary.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's that they want it. It's just, I think that kind of things work better in a way when you have a common enemy.
Yep.
Because, you know, if you don't have a common enemy, then there is this natural inclination to kind of like look for it. It's not like you're wanting it, but it's like there's a hole in your view of the world if there isn't this bad guy. Okay. And we have this classic God and the devil,
yes,
type thing. And then, you know, a lot more people are less religious now, or the religion doesn't, you know, inform their views of politics so much. So that kind of comes across as being, you know, the bad guy,
yep,
you know, the people who are trying to do things. And in the United States in particular, we had, dating back to this time of Kennedy and before that, in the 50s, we have the Red Scare, which is still very, very much a big part of how Americans view the world and how their conspiracy theories kind of fit into, you know, this view, and how communism fits in there. They think the bad guy for a lot of people is socialism.
Yes.
Yeah, which, you know, I'm from Britain and, you know, you're from Australia, so our ideas of what socialism is probably a bit different to Americans. Like, I view it as being, you know, like free healthcare and welfare and things like that. Yeah. The social contract, taking care of people. But in America, people essentially have been indoctrinated since the 1950s to varying degrees, that socialism is this evil thing, that, yes, if you let it in, it leads to communism, and communism is going to lead to this totalitarian dictatorship with everybody being in work camps. And it'll be like Stalinist Russia.
Yes.
So people are afraid of the bad communism, and they see these plots, these conspiracies, as essentially part of a broader conspiracy to bring in some kind of new world order, some kind of socialist totalitarian dictatorship,
which, you know, free healthcare, that'd be terrible. But you see this, though, with, again, going back to the division and people being polarized nowadays, you see this with even, say, people looking at conservatives. I have a lot of conservative friends, but I wouldn't consider mm-hmm. them Nazis. But nowadays, a lot of people who say they're conservative, in other people's minds, they'll go straight to, they must be an absolutely horrible person because they identify as conservative. And likewise, I see a lot of my conservative friends who will think of my liberal friends and go, why do you hang out with them? You know, they're liberals. They're probably communists. You know that, right?
Yeah.
And I go, they're not communists. And then I say to my liberal friends, they're not Nazis. They just, a lot of times they agree on a lot of things, but they never talk to actually figure out. There's more common ground than not half the time.
Yeah, and I think like a key part of kind of moving forward as a society, as a world, is talking to people and figuring out what that common ground is. I think you talk about conservatives, and there's a bunch of various different things that define conservatism, and a lot of these things overlap between different people. Some people are fiscally conservative. Yep. They don't like excessive government spending, which, you know, is something a lot of people who are liberals could agree with, like, but then they might disagree on where that excessive spending is. Like, are we spending too much on the Defense Department, you know, the War Department? Or are we spending too much on social programs, you know, those things? And in some ways, that becomes then a matter of detail. Yeah, you know, we agree that, you know, we need some kind of army, some kind of defense department. We agree that we need some kind of social programs, like, you know, in the United States, we have Social Security at the very least, and things like Medicaid, Medicare. But the disagreement is kind of like on how much.
Yeah.
It's not really about, you know, what, you know, what should the minimum wage be? Should it be $10 or should it be $20 or should it be somewhere in between? It's like this negotiation that we have between people. But people like to frame it as a choice between two absolutes. It's freedom versus communism. And that's all you've got to go between. But
exactly.
That's not how the world works.
And see,
the world is a compromise.
Exactly right. And I find this for me, like a lot of time I find myself being very utilitarian, in the sense of when I look at when I served in the military, I agree that we need a military, enjoyed my service, but I saw the waste that we had. I saw the things we threw away that we didn't need to throw away. The change of uniform simply because we wanted a different type of button on the uniform or a different bit of Velcro. This waste of uniform. And I compare that to my grandfather's day as a rat of Tobruk, rat of Tobruk in El Alamein and all that. And they would salvage every piece of their uniform. There was nothing that they did. Like if there was a rifle, they would salvage it and rebuild the rifle. He was artillery, so they would take two exploded artillery pieces, try to piece them together into one working one. Nowadays we go, you know, we're just going to buy a new one. We're just going to dispose of that. And I think that a lot of people, when they see the military budget, they think, okay, we're getting new tanks, so we're getting new missiles. They don't realize how much we actually throw away. And I think this is where people need to do a bit more research before they speak about things. They'll say, no, we need budget cuts to the military. No. We need budget cuts to certain parts of the military, not just an overall budget cut, you know?
There's lots of programs in the military that are very, very expensive and perhaps were not entirely necessary, like the F-35 fighter. Next generation fighter is going to have it's going to cost over $1 trillion over its lifetime, which is ridiculous. We could have just not done it and just upgraded our FA-18s.
And then we've got us in Australia. We bought a bunch of the Tiger helicopters from France. Brilliant helicopter, amazing helicopter. Until you take them to the desert, because they have a really large intake port And when you fly them in the desert, when you land them, they suck up all the sand, and it's so hot, it basically it turns into glass, and it clogs up the engine. So you can't actually fly them. So I had a friend who was a pilot over there. He said, yeah, we bought billions of dollars worth of these helicopters, and they were all sitting on ground, and we had to rent helicopters from the Americans. And you consider that's a helicopter that's designed for the jungle. It's designed for wet areas in Europe. It's not designed for the desert. And yeah, it's things like that people don't see the budgets of governments get wasted on. But that's not something that we're ever going to really change. It's the that's all the war hawks in there that want their bigger and better weapons.
No, but I guess the point there though is that people aren't saying let's abolish the military. Yeah, you got to get away from these highly polarized things and recognize that both sides have some kind of nuance. And if they don't, then they should, and that's something that we should move towards in our discussions and try to boil down to what the actual disagreement is. If you're a conservative or a liberal or somewhere in between, or an independent or a libertarian or whatever, you've got different opinions, but it's not like these camps do not overlap. We still live in the same society, and we're still doing the same types of things. We still have the same goals and desires and aspirations, and we raise families and we have careers. So we've got an enormous amount of overlap, much more overlap than non-overlap. So we can work together.
Well, before we move on, I want to move on to a separate topic in a minute. But honestly, nowadays I wake up in the morning and I wait for someone to tell me which camp I'm in. One day someone will tell me I'm a lefty. One day they'll tell me I'm right. Depending on who I'm talking to. And also I don't know what I am. I know what I believe in. But I don't really assign myself to a group. I probably am if I did one of those, have you ever tried those, the political tests that tells you what group you'd be in? I did one
with
of those.
The squares.
Yeah. No lie. I was right in the middle. Ended up right in the middle. I went, that's helpful. Great.
I think I was pretty close to the middle. Yeah. Bit to the left, libertarian side-ish. I can't remember exactly that. What it worked out.
Yeah. Because we'll probably wrap this up soon. When did you, what made you get into, and when did you get into, the debunking and the skeptical side of things?
The skeptical side of things really is something I've just always been interested in since I was a teenager. My brother used to get a magazine called Unexplained, which was back in the 80s, I think. And it was basically just things like UFOs and ghosts and magical type things and strange mysteries and sea monsters and Bigfoot. And it was just fascinating stuff to read about. And then I became very interested in science as I got older and read a lot of science fiction, read a lot of popular science books. And the two things kind of combined into using science to try to figure out things. Why is something happening? And, as time went by, I kind of developed just various useful skill sets, like tracking down planes, which I did for the whole chemtrail thing. That got to be very useful for analyzing UFO videos. And you get very familiar with various aspects of photography and things. And you just get better at it and you get more familiar with things. And it's just something that's kind of, crept up on me over many, many years. I mean, I started my chemtrail debunking back in 2015, 2016, 2006, sorry. So nearly 18 years ago or so. So it's just something that I've just been doing for a long time, and I enjoy doing it.
Yeah, excellent. My chemtrail debunking happened very quickly for me. I have a pilot's license, and I started flying into some larger airports, and I'd be hanging around the garage with a few people just while plane mobbing getting an oil change or something. And I just make a joke every so often. So where do you keep the big buckets of chemicals? And everyone just laugh, and they're like, honestly, mate, if we tried to hide any stuff like that in these garage, the aerodromes and that, they said it'd be highly illegal. the amount of the chemical data sheets, for instance. They said everyone has to have a chemical data sheet of what chemicals are on the airport at all times in case a fire breaks out, and then the fire brigade needs to look at the chemical data sheet. And they said if there was some sort of mind controlling chemical, fire brigade would have found it by now when they do their checks every year, every month. So
And that's the type of context that you need. You know, the fact that there is this oversight of what goes on planes. It would have to be some kind of very compartmentalized thing. They would have to be flying out of secret bases and being loaded by black ops crews, and it was sworn to secrecy, and they like the Manhattan Project. But you know, the what we see in the sky, these trails, they're just coming from regular planes. And it, actually, Australia is kind of an interesting place for chemtrails, because there's some places in Australia, like Perth, that have very, very few overflights.
Okay.
So you almost never see contrails.
Oh, wow. So because we see them all the time planes, here, because we have an airport here. But
you're in Melbourne?
No, I'm in rural New South Wales. So that's central New South Wales.
Okay, so is that like kind of like the Gold Coast area?
No, so we go Sydney and then go west of Sydney about 8 hours.
All right, yeah,
five to 8 hours.
Yeah, so you'd be on the route there between like Sydney and Perth.
Yep.
So you would probably see things like and possibly some international routes as well. But there are places like in New Zealand, Auckland.
Yep.
Almost never has a plane fly over it. That's flying to Auckland is flying into Auckland or out of Auckland. So you never see these planes fly over them. If someone grows up in somewhere like Perth or Auckland, and then they see their first contrail, they're going to be like, oh my God, it's real.
I've got friends here that we know that we live around trails that the planes will take, but people look up and they go, but Steve, you see they cross over each other and they're making a symbol in the sky. And I'm like, from this angle, yes. But if I go and I stand on that mountain over there, it looks completely different. And they go,
No,
it would look the same.
that kind of ties back into what we were talking about earlier about the way people's brains work differently. A lot of people have a hard time visualizing complex 3D things.
Yes.
And what you're talking about, there is like planes flying overhead and other planes flying this way. When a plane flies directly away from you or directly towards you, it looks like it's flying straight up in the air.
Yeah.
Which is kind of a weird kind of optical illusion, but it's something that some people just cannot wrap their heads around.
Certainly.
Perhaps because some people are like have this aphantasia type thing where they don't form very good mental visual imagery. Even people who aren't aphantasic have issues with kind of 3D perception. Like, you know, I can kind of visualize, I can kind of imagine flying up around and looking at the contrail from the side or from above, because it's the type of thing I do all the time. But a lot of people, they see trail go up, rocket, and that's as far as it goes.
I've taken friends up with me I don't own a plane. I rent one every so often, hire one. And I've taken friends up with me, and they'll tell me they didn't realize what sort of perspective you have in the sky once until you're up there. And I've flown at an angle, and we went out to Sydney there one day, flew out over the ocean, and it was quite a cloudy day, and flew up to a point where you couldn't distinguish the sky from the ocean. And I said to them, how would you know that you are flying upside down right now? I said, if you were strapped in, our plane was small, so it wasn't an issue. But I said, if you were strapped in, how would you actually know apart from, your suitcase hitting the ceiling? And they said, good point. The sky looked like the ocean. And it's not until they get up there and they see, what things look like from that perspective, and they go, oh, okay, yeah, no, I can start to see that 3D image a bit mm-hmm. clearer now.
Yeah.
Now, something that now this is a bit more of a controversial thing. I've seen you cop a bit of flack on the internet from this, and that is your analysis of the gimbal footage while we're talking about aircraft. Amazing work, honestly. I absolutely loved it. it's one of those things. I followed the gimbal footage since it came out, and I won't lie, I was one of the first people to sit there and go, "Oh my God, we've found it! It's done! It's proven!" I got on the hype train very early, and then I started. Yeah, I'd listen to the interviews of certain people. I'd analyze, you know, the time of day it was and stuff like that. And there was an inkling in me going, there's something not right about this, especially being a pilot myself. And it was when you, towards the end of your video, which I'll link for everyone listening, I'll link into the description. You've all got to have a look at Mick's video. It's excellent. It's when you say about how the perspective of the gimbal, and as it's rotating, so is the image, but the horizon isn't rotating, and mm-hmm. you're explaining how the gimbal works, and you know, it could be an object, it could be this, but it also could be a lens flare. And I was like, and when you start talking about lens flares, I thought, yes, I've seen lens flares through my own sunglasses coming through the cockpit of my plane. And as you turn the plane, you can see it visually yourself.
Yeah.
Never put that together with the gimbal. Never thought to.
Yeah.
And then you consider the rotation of the gimbal.
You can amazing. Do like a really simple replication of that type of thing you're talking about there, just by kind of squinting. If you squint so, and then move your head around, you've got to squint so that lights kind of form streaks. So you look at a single light and, you know, get it, squint at it so it's kind of a bit streaky, and then turn your head around, you will see, you know, this rotates because the streak direction is formed by your eyelashes.
Yes.
And they're just basically the shape of your eyelids. And so if you do this, it's essentially the same thing as what's going on there. But it's one of those things that has been a constant challenge to explain to people. Like, you know, every day someone says, "Well, if the camera's rotating, why doesn't the horizon rotate?" Debunked.
Yeah.
And you know, then you have to try to explain it to them again. And it's complicated because people don't understand. Because if you look at my video, I take it in steps and kind of build up the explanation. So each thing depends upon something else. So I have to explain how the camera works, what these gimbals actually do and how they go up and down, and then why is there a derotation mechanism in the camera, and you know, what does that do? And it's difficult to follow. It's difficult to explain, but it's also very difficult to follow, and it's totally understandable that lots of people don't believe me just because they don't get the explanation.
Yeah, I think it's also from reading some comments that I've seen pop up on Twitter and some YouTube channels referring to you. Got the last couple of weeks. We were supposed to do this interview last week, didn't work out. But last few weeks, I've been watching interviews from both sides of the fence regarding you. Some things pop up here and there, and a lot of the people I notice who do want to come out against your video or your analysis are people who want to believe. It's the sense that I get. They're people who want to who have got a lot tied. And this might be a controversial thing, but people have got a lot tied to the UFO community. They've got books, they've got movies, DVDs. They've got all these things tied to it. If this gets debunked, then does that mean I'm going to lose book sales? And
it does seem that people want it to be an interesting thing, because so much of the recent UFO phenomena has come from these videos. This whole thing started with the New York Times article, "Glowing Auras and Black Money." And if you go to the webpage of that article, right at the top, there is the gimbal video, and it looks amazing, and is mentioned in the headline, "Glowing Auras," even though the aura in the video is just an artifact of the image sharpening. It's not anything amazing at all.
Yeah.
People don't even want to admit that. I talked to Lou Elizondo about it, and I said, "Well, you know, it's just this image sharpening artifact." And he's like, "Well, you've got your ideas about that, and I've got my ideas." They he didn't want to let it go.
Heat. They want to. They refer to that as heat, don't they? They think it's a heat signal.
There's all these mixed perceptions about what we're actually talking about. People talk about heat signatures.
Yep.
And they mention heat signatures as if it's this kind of specific thing, like, I don't know, there's like some kind of little graph you can draw, which is the heat signature, or there's some very specific shape. And then you realize for some of them, when they talk about heat signatures, you know, this is like we're talking about looking, excuse me, looking at planes through thermal cameras. You know, what is the heat signature of a plane? Heat signature, all that means the heat signature is what the object looks like to a thermal camera.
Yes.
Excuse me, I'm just going to have a quick drink.
Well, I've seen this before with thermals that we'd use in the military. When we use thermals out in the we'd do training out in some of the Australian forests, and they can be quite dense. But if someone 10 kilometers away on another hill lights up a cigarette in their camp, it looks like someone set a flare off. Heat signatures through a thermal are very distinct. They're not generally something that you go, oh, maybe. You know, generally, you look at a heat signature and you go, yes, that's a heat signature. I can look through if one of my buddies is on the ground on picket with the machine gun. Once he stands up, I can look at where he was lying and see a heat signature on the ground for a short period of time. I can look at that machine gun and I can see that it's if he's been firing it, there's a clear heat signature there. And the thermals that we use and a lot of other people use, I know firefighters use them as well, rescue operators use them. Depending on the setting you're using, it goes off. Okay, so if the hottest temperature is 800 degrees, then something that's 50 degrees probably won't register, because it's locked onto the 800 degrees. Something that's 100 degrees will come up as not really something we need to be concerned about. Is that sort of, does the gimbal do the same thing, do you think? Or
To a certain degree, but you know, you look at the gimbal video and you can see clouds in the background, and you can see some definition in the clouds. So you're getting some dynamic range there. It's not just like the gimbal is you know, whitewashing out the entire scene. But it does appear that it's you see this in other thermal images when you see, like, say, a missile coming down and blowing up something. You'll see, if it's in black hot mode, like a momentary big black blob appears around that. But you can often still see the image around. So a lot of the times these thermal cameras can actually manage to capture both detail in the background and have glare as well. But you know, with the gimbal, the tells for the glare are basically the way it rotates. You see it at the start of the video, the 20 seconds of the video, the plane banks three times in this first 20 seconds of the video, totaling about 12 degrees rotation. You see the plane bank because the artificial horizon rotates, and you see the horizon bank as well. So you see the clouds, the angle the clouds are moving at changes. Yep. But the object itself doesn't. It remains fixed on the screen, fixed relative to the camera, which only makes sense if it's some kind of camera artifact. Doesn't mean there's nothing there. You know, there's something hot behind this camera artifact. But there's this, and there's a bunch of other things that really very, very strongly point to it being some kind of glare.
Yep.
And we don't know, you know, there's other unanswered questions. We don't know how far away it is or how big it is. But yeah, I think we can say with a lot of confidence that it's probably glare and not the actual object shape that's rotating.
Certainly. Speaking of the distance, where is it? Because I've watched your video in its entirety a few times now. Where is it that where are people like David Fravor and a few others and Alessandro, where are they getting their information that this was X amount of meters away from the aircraft? How are they extrapolating that?
They're using, as far as I know, there's only one person who's spoken out about that, which is a guy called Ryan Graves.
Yep.
And he says that he watched, I think, essentially a replay of some of the tapes And it's very vague as to exactly what he saw. And I keep asking him about it and asking him to talk to me so I can go through it in some depth. But he basically says that they saw something that was 6 to 8 miles away. Actually, I think he didn't say how far away it was when they started, but when they got to about 6 to 8 miles away, they thought they were too close, and so they left it alone, which again is a bit bizarre. And yeah, he describes the object flying along, and then a fleet of five things in a V formation, which were kind of following it, and then this object stops, and these five go around it, and then the object goes back in the other direction. So it gives this kind of very vague, almost hand-wavy description of what happened, and people are kind of saying that this is the definitive account of what happened. So they take this number, 6 to 8 miles, and I think they say that maybe it started at 10 miles, 10 nautical miles. But we don't know if that's accurate. We just have one guy's recollection from years ago to go by. We don't have any real data on that. And if you do analysis of the lines of sight, it could be something that's 6 miles away, but it would have to be doing this kind of a weird trajectory with this very strange acceleration profile, which, if it's an alien spaceship or whatever, or like an anti-gravity craft, then yeah, sure. Or it could be something that's more or less a straight line about 30 miles away, just kind of flying away with its tail pointing more or less towards the camera. So you've got multiple possible solutions. There's this general problem in UFOs is that we have 2D images, like a video. And for any point on the screen, it could be anywhere on the line between the camera and infinity far away. So if you don't know how big something is, you don't know how far away it is. And we don't know how big it is. We don't know how far away it is. We do know that there's a straight line solution that more or less works. And then there's an infinite number of kind of weird wibbly solutions that are closer to the camera.
Yeah, and I think we need to think more along the lines of Occam's razor here. The most reliable sources that we have, and I think when I looked at your video, it was like that glass shattering in my head. As soon as I got to the end of it, I can't. Every time I watch it now, regardless of whether it's got your overlays on it or not, I see it. I'm like, now I can see the lens flare. Now it does make sense, from someone who's flown before at the controls. Now I'm like, yeah, I can see how this would be mistaken. My other concern with all this is I think there's we've gotten to a point where a lot of these people, there's a lot of celebrity now around the ufology, and I think it's getting to a point where there's a lot of people who have come out and said things earlier on who either have to disappear and not talk. Like we've seen that with Dave Fravor. He's pretty much dropped off the map. I really haven't seen much from him at all. And I think he's a genuinely nice person. All the interviews I've watched, I think he had good intentions. I just think that he might have been led a bit astray by the likes of people like To the Stars Academy and, pumping up this more cinematic style of it all. I don't know what your thoughts are on that. Celebrity's getting a bit too much of it all.
I think people get a bit of fatigue in these things. Like Fravor's got other things to do with his life, and he's never really made this to be like what his life is about, like some people in the UFO community do.
Yes.
You think like Lou Elizondo, his entire life essentially is, well, his career now is, I'm not saying this in a negative way, just that it's become an all-encompassing thing for him.
Yep.
But Fravor and, say, Alex Dietrich, the other pilot, and others, like, I think it's less so. Then you've got Ryan Graves, who now works for an odd startup to do with quantum technology and consciousness and artificial intelligence creating new materials, which has this kind of weird links towards ufology and in that it's kind of like this kind of out there. It's a pretty speculative technology.
Okay.
So, people have different perspectives on it and the different levels of involvement. You know, you could argue that I perhaps have more involvement in UFOs than David Fravor does because he's not done very much recently. But he's still, you know, he sticks by his story. He's still very adamant that he saw this flying Tic Tac, and he probably saw something.
I guess I have respect for anyone who wants to come out and tell their stories, but I have a bit more respect for him because the story hasn't changed for him. He hasn't glorified anything out of it. It hasn't gone from I saw this aircraft, and he never really talks about being an alien thing. Yeah, I've watched him on Joe Rogan and a few other podcasts he did, and even when people are trying to get him to say, "Oh yeah, it's aliens," he never really takes the bait, and he generally always like just goes, "No, it's an aircraft of some sort. I don't know any more than that," and I respect that he hasn't felt that he needs to. Okay, well, I could if I just say alien. If I say that I was given a document that said it was an alien craft, that's all he would have to say. And he would make a ton of money out of UFO books and documentaries. And, nothing wrong. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with anyone, to my listeners out there, especially anyone who wants to make money out of this. I've got no problem with that. Yeah, I just have an issue with people who know what they're saying is false. What do you think? I don't know what's going on at the moment
it's the aliens. They've discovered that we're talking about them.
I was going to say, probably a few of my listeners will probably say, yep, see.
Yes.
The
deep state.
The deep state, yeah, they're coming to get me. I'll look outside for black helicopters. your thought. We'll wrap this up in a minute because I think that's going to get worse, the dropout. When it comes to Lou, for instance, a lot of respect for the guy, but when I go into looking up some of his past stuff, there's been no real proof of connection that he was actually in an alien UFO. Intelligence group. There's proof that he was in the aerial threat group, but aerial threat doesn't automatically mean aliens. I'm thinking about missiles and enemies of your country.
Super bothered by all that though, and I kind of accept that he was in some kind of government funded body and that type of thing, like investigating the ORSAP or an ATIP. Other people do a better job of that than I do. I'm not really super interested in going through old documents and memos and doing Freedom of Information Act. I analyze videos. But I think that Lou essentially is a true believer.
Yep.
I think he perhaps uses methods to further his goals. I think he genuinely wants there to be disclosure of what he believes to be alien craft visiting the Earth, and he thinks this is real, and he thinks that it's important, and he's doing his best to do that. But I think perhaps he's goes a little bit far sometimes and is perhaps sometimes a little bit deceptive. Like he had this sock puppet account a while back, Faceless Bureaucrat, which was basically his account, and he was tweeting from it. And then someone asked him about it on a podcast, and he kind of hemmed and hawed about it and never really admitted it. And it's things like that that I think that even though he essentially means well, you can't always trust 100% what he's saying.
Yeah.
And I think he also has very motivated reasoning as well, or at least it's hard to say. It's like, when I talk to him about, the aura in the gimbal video, there's this aura around it, which is just this camera artifact.
Yep.
Yeah. It seemed like that was a slam dunk. Even Jeremy Corbell, who is this kind of out there filmmaker, admitted that that was just a camera artifact. He just said that on Joe Rogan, but Lou is unwilling to let things go, and I think he ends up having to defend a position that becomes increasingly untenable rather than just simply adjusting things as new information comes in. Yeah, sure, we can we can drop the aura because that's not a real thing, but perhaps you could still continue fighting for the rotation or the fact that it was too close and didn't show up on the radar and things like that. So but you don't have to stick with 100% of every single thing you've ever believed. You should be able to modify your position when new data comes in.
I know where you're coming from with that. And I've seen a lot of sometimes it's not so much the person who's saying it, it's the groups behind them. It's the amount of people they have following them. I still get emails from them. I don't know if you've ever heard of of Billy Meyer.
Yes.
Yes, I did a full breakdown on him. My first half of my episode was all about his story. My second half was why I think it's all bunk. And I still get emails from groups saying that. I had one group tell me that we know that you live in Western Australia and we know that your kids go to this and this school. And I thought, well, great. I'm happy that you believe that because you're so far from the truth. I've never even been to Western Australia. But they get very and
it's almost cult-like, isn't it?
It is like very cult-like. Actually in the middle of doing
their cult leader.
I'm in the middle of doing probably next few months. I'm doing a bunch of episodes all about cults, how they're formed. Mm. What to look out for in friends and family, because I'm starting to see a lot of that cult mentality happening. I love all this stuff. I love ufology, cryptozoology, all these things, paranormal. But there always comes to a point where someone starts following some sort of a leader and this cult-like mentality. I'm seeing this now with I've got friends with the whole anti-vax stuff and so I figured, I'm going to start doing some, this is how it starts and this is how it ends, what to keep an eye out for, but just talk about some of those cults that have popped up out of nothing.
Well, there's UFO cults, historically speaking, the Heaven's Gate cult was a UFO cult. Very much so. I mean, it was the UFO was like a word that they spoke every day because they were just talking about when are the UFOs going to come and take us away to the next plane of existence, and then they didn't turn up in time, so they forced the issue by killing themselves. And this is it's a danger. There's a woman now called Angel who's been talking about things that remind me of the Heaven's Gate cult. Talking about how people need to transcend this reality.
I've been watching some of her interviews with people. It is dangerous thinking. Yeah, it's all fun and games when we're talking about little green men coming out of spaceships. Yeah. But when we start talking about, you need to commit to this, you need to commit to that, doctrines and followers and stuff like that, it gets very, very gray. But We're going to wrap things up. Thank you so much for coming on, Mick. I'd love to have you back on again because I think there's a few other things I'd love to discuss with you. One of the ones I'd love to talk to you about is the machine elves and things like that. Some of the more psychotropic things I think would be a very interesting discussion in the future. It's been wonderful having you on the show.
Yeah, it's been a very interesting conversation. Thank you very much.
One last question before you go.
Sure.
So do you believe we've been visited by aliens?
I don't know. I wouldn't say yes or no. I don't think there's solid evidence, but I wouldn't rule it out.
Excellent. No, I just know I've had a few people who knew I was interviewing you say, look, just ask him if he actually believes they've been here or not. Because I don't think you're that hardcore skeptic that goes chasing after people just to shut down their beliefs. I do respect how you treat the people from the communities.
I'm trying to figure things out. Like when someone shows me a UFO case, my goal isn't to prove that it's not a UFO. It's to figure out what's actually there. And if it ends up being some kind of anti-gravity flying saucer, that would be pretty awesome.
I would love it.
So far, no such luck.
I would love it. And I'll tell you now, when after I watched your video, I went upstairs, saw my wife, and she said, "Why do you look, you look down?" I said, "Yeah, I just had my whole belief in the Tic Tac footage blown away." But so thanks for that. No, it is an excellent video. I'll link it in the description. Have a look at it, and also have a look at Mick's book. That is, sorry, I'll just bring it up, Escaping the Rabbit Hole. And I'll definitely be buying a copy. All right, Mick, thank you again. And I'll talk to you again soon.
Great. All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. So that was my interview with Mick West. I was a bit nervous there sometimes. It's very different interviewing someone from the skeptical side. I don't interview many people like that. I don't interview as many people who are so well versed in science and engineering as Mick is. So I was a little bit nervous there sometimes, and maybe I did speak over him a few times. So I do apologize for that. But I think overall it was a pretty good interview. I think, as I said at the start, Mick can be a very controversial character amongst the ufology groups. Because he says things they may not be happy about. And he does do quite a bit of debunking. And it's very hard to not agree with some of the things he debunks, especially when he shows you the tools and the means of how you can do it yourself at home with basic software. So really important that we do keep an open mind with these things. So, yeah. I hope you all enjoyed it. If you didn't enjoy it, that you at least respect that we're having conversations with both sides. I think that's really important. And yeah, this is the first episode since I come back. I'm really happy to be back, and hopefully I'll be talking to you all soon. I'll be looking at this week getting some more recording done, and possibly an oddball file coming out on some strange creature. I think I want to jump into some let's go with the Jersey Devil or something, maybe. It could be a bit of fun, but for now, it's been a while, but look after each other and stay safe out there in the weird. Good night.